a standard that I think would be the standard on the, under the current law. In other words, I think that, that the current interpretation would allow various sorts of personality disorders, for example, to qualify as mental disorders. So one of the ways to reduce the physical impact on the dangerousness side, as if you're expanding the scope of dangerousness, is to contract it in the other term, that is to adopt a somewhat more restrictive notion of mental disorder. And I think that would be responsive to the concerns that have been expressed here today, that as people are worried about schizophrenics, about seriously mentally ill people, I think that that can be accomplished without using the civil commitment law to sweep in everybody that has some sort of anxiety attack.
Mr. Chairman.
One moment.
Yeah.
Representative Bellamy.
Let me ask you a couple of questions before we go into the details of your amendments.
Yeah.
I assume that you would be supportive of changing the definitions.
My basic position is that clarifying the definition of a mentally ill person would be extremely desirable. I feel it would be desirable to accomplish that in a way that does not have any physical impact.
The only reason I ask that question is because it's obvious that you've given us a lot of technical amendments here,
yeah,
which is very good. I assume you probably have not worked with the psychiatrist, Oregon Association of Psychiatrists.
That's right.
And I know what the suggestion is going to be of the committee after you get all through this, and you may not want to go through the technical amendments, but it'd be for you to sit down with their association and discuss these. Because we generally in these technical areas look to, you know, and probably would say that if, when you get through with all of these, we'll probably suggest that we might save you the time and let you just tell us what you think of the bill in general.
That's fine. I'd be happy to give a copy of this to the to the Oregon Psychiatric Association lobbyist.
And I assume you wouldn't mind working with him either.
Sure. No, that's fine. And I didn't want to go through these in every detail, so please don't get me wrong on this. I'm not going to walk through all of my things. I wanted to give you some general idea about what I was trying to accomplish.
I'm very curious. You say you're about to get your PhD in this field as a lawyer.
Well,
any particular reason? Interest?
Before I was a lawyer, I was studying philosophy and in political philosophy, and I was doing my work in the area of involuntary civil commitment as a problem in political philosophy, and I did that more or less concurrently with earning my law degree. It doesn't have any short-term value to me, except for committee proceedings such as this.
You wonder.
Let one of the people that you work with, Hardy Myers, know that you said that.
Uh-huh. Hardy told me that too. So.
No. We're going to tell him what you just said. No short-term value to this.
Mr.
Right.
Chair.
Yes,
we don't often get somebody with your legal training and expertise in this particular area. What's your general philosophy on the involuntary commitment when we're talking about a mental disorder? And I'm talking about a severe mental disorder.
Well, that's a difficult question. I think that the civil commitment laws that we have now date from an earlier generation. And I think that they have not kept up with the tremendous revolutions that have occurred in mental health care since the early 1950s. I guess my basic feeling is that is that the mental health system in Oregon is pretty good. That is, given a relatively restricted amount of resources, I think that we do an awful good job of treating mentally ill people. I think the mental illness law is in disastrous shape. I think the statutes are vague and grant a great deal of room of discretion, which allows room for abuse. And because Oregon has a very highly decentralized system, that is, there's a lot of county autonomy, I think that it's important to provide people with statutory standards which have some clarity. So I think my basic feeling in this area is that the mental illness statutes have to be clarified in order to provide the people who are out in the trenches with more guidance.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you. Did you have more? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't mean
my question went
sure.
through this quickly. Without walking through all the details, I wanted to just suggest the ideas that I was
sure.
that I was trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
The second of my proposed amendments would also, I think, contract again what the Psychiatric Association is trying to expand in the notion of danger. I think that it would, and this, there's been a lot of case law on what the notion of dangerousness should mean. And one of the ideas that cases have come up with is that danger should only result in commitment if it is an imminent danger resulting from recent overt acts. Some cases have held that's a constitutional requirement. I think it would be desirable to put a standard like that in the statute. Once again, I don't think that works against the idea that the Psychiatric Association is pushing for, but it would make the definition narrower. The third amendment is a sort of laundry list of places where the term mentally ill person occurs in the statute. I think if you walk through ORS 426, what you find is there's a definition of mentally ill person at the beginning, and then there are various procedures by which a person can get committed, but they don't clearly relate back to the definition of mentally ill person. And they have all kinds of different standards as you walk through different ways. I mean, some of them say need of treatment, some of them say in need of hospitalization, so mentally ill as to be in need of hospitalization. There are all these different standards at every place in the statute you look. And so it seems to me that what there should be is a single standard for what says, for what counts as the threshold beyond which a person would be susceptible to commitment, and then that standard should be carried in a uniform fashion throughout the various procedures by which commitment can be accomplished. So I appreciate that these are technical amendments which may not be terribly clear in the face, but I was mainly hoping that Mr. Barilla or Ms. Diamond or someone else would take the time to walk through this stuff and see if it makes any sense.
And let me let the others in the audience know that the committee staff office will have more copies of these suggested amendments tomorrow. And there may be a few extra copies now, but those will be available in our staff offices. Thank you again. Gyneth Owen.
Gyneth. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, as I am Gyneth Owen and I reside in Molina, Oregon, and as a parent of a daughter that has been mentally ill for 7 years, and also as a president of the Oregon Alliance of Advocates for the Mentally Ill, which is a statewide coalition of family support groups and other interested individuals working to improve the quality of life for the mentally ill, I support House Bill 2640. This bill, if enacted, should make it easier for us as parents and as advocates to get our loved ones committed to the mental health division for care, and hopefully before they have deteriorated mentally and many times physically too, to the extent that we fear for their lives. We spend many anguished hours watching our family member become ill again and are currently sitting on the sidelines waiting and praying that nothing happens that causes them to become either involved in the criminal system as an accused, an accused criminal or as a victim, or even worse yet, that they become another suicide statistic in the news before they have relapsed enough that they are committable under the current laws. We feel that this bill would be a step towards seeing that they receive the treatment sooner, and so hope that this legislature will see fit to enact it as it is written. And then I would like to make one response. That's my testimony, but I would like to make one response to the Oregon Community Mental Health Director's concern about those people not falling into priority one because of lack of funds. And so therefore the Community Mental Health Directors don't have the dollars. Before House Bill 2404 was passed, many of the community mental health programs throughout the nation were not trying to treat the severely, chronically mentally ill, for they're not easy people to treat. And so those people were housed in the state institutions. And so since we do have the deinstitutionalization program, which is good, and they are treatable in the community, I think that their concern about what I would term the walking well, and I know I get a lot of trouble from my own community mental health program director and some of the people on his staff because I'm on his advisory committee. When I term them the walking well, it's true that they are ill. People are depressed and have anxieties, and they may need treating, but they're not so ill that they're completely unable to function, or a great number of them are not. Some of them, of course, if they get to where they can't function, they could also be committed. Okay,
are there questions from the committee members? Thank you very much. I think it's Hilden or Hilder Wolf. Hilden. You'll have to speak a little louder, please.
I said, I am going to bring you testimony of a personal nature.
Okay.
I am for House Bill 2640, which redefines mental illness for purposes of commitment law. My name is Hilda Wolf. I'm testifying on behalf of 2640. In August of 1983, my husband became acutely ill with bipolar disease, also known as manic depression. I saw a dramatic change in his personality from a conservative, responsible person who in 40 years of driving had received only one traffic citation. He would never, at most he would have one beer if we went out, if he were driving. His behavior changed to an erratic person. He was very elated, and he had delusions of grandeur. He began drinking at all hours of the day. He was involved in a one-car accident in which he received minor injuries on August 29, 1983. He was admitted on a two-physician hold for treatment in a local hospital in their psychiatric unit. The county mental health investigator evaluated him for a commitment, but felt the only reason for a commitment found was his statements regarding driving 80 miles an hour around a curve with no concern for endangering others. My husband's diagnosis of bipolar disease, the usual course of the illness, nor my concern for my inability to control his drinking and driving were not taken into consideration. He was discharged on September 9th after only 2 days of treatment with lithium. Therapeutic blood levels of lithium require 5 to 10 days to be built up for the control of the hypomania of bipolar disease. Many studies show that people with bipolar disease frequently self-treat with alcohol as well as other drugs. On 9/26, 10/22, and 10/23 of 83, my husband was involved in 3 more driving under the influence accidents. Fortunately, nobody was injured. During the next year, we were involved in a divorce action in my attempt to protect our assets. My husband was placed under conservatorship for 6 months. The 3 legal actions as a result of the driving under the influence offenses resulted in my husband becoming so depressed, suicide was a real concern. I firmly believe my husband would not be alive today were it not for our wonderful, wonderful psychiatrist. He has an exceptional knowledge of appropriate medication and intervention. His mental illness defense was not allowed, and his license is now suspended for 3 years. I feel a change in the definition of mental illness for purposes of commitment law is mandatory to allow the mentally ill treatment for their illness at the appropriate time, rather than legal punishment for acts committed as a result of lack of adequate treatment for the illness. My husband was in the hospital. He was being treated for the illness. We were paying for the treatment, but the law gave him the right to make a decision regarding further treatment, even though his judgment was impaired by his mental illness. Our present commitment law, I feel, would allow him not to endanger others, possibly, and thus not endangering others. I am for. I really urge you to pass on
Thank you, and we certainly appreciate your taking the time to be with us today. Are there questions from the committee members? Thank you. Stevie Remington. Two other witnesses signed up after that, Mr. Gray and Ms. Judy Johnson.
I do have a prepared statement to distribute to the committee, which I will summarize. This statement was prepared not by me, but by one of our founders. I'm sorry, I'm Stevie Remington, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. And this written statement was prepared by Mike Katz, who is a founder of our organization. And he addresses the question of the definition, which was prepared by a task force in 1972, of which Mike Katz was a member, which was chaired by Dr. Dean Brooks, and it drafted the present commitment law and recommended this definition of a mentally ill person. It was a monumental improvement over the previous commitment law, and we supported its enactment while opposing the principle of involuntary commitment when a person hasn't demonstrated dangerousness to others by reason of criminal acts. That is, we don't take the position that we should have involuntary commitment on prediction that of future dangerousness. And as Mike says, and I have to read some of this, it would substitute, the present bill would substitute technical jargon for plain English. Instead of two simple and unambiguous possibilities, House Bill 2640 would chop up the definition into 5 complicated permutations. for example, one of the five definitions is one who, quote, manifests severe deterioration in routine functioning evidenced by repeating and escalating loss of cognitive or volitional control over personal actions and is not receiving such care as essential for personal health and safety. Need more be said? Aside from this arcane and tortured terminology, the inescapable inference in that language is that as soon as a person does receive such care, he or she is no longer mentally ill. At last, the miraculous cure we have all awaited. He addresses in the next paragraph several other behaviors or definitions that are equally bad and mischievous as he describes them and how they could be strictly constructed. And asserts that psychiatrists may not be the only people who understand what this pretentious gobbledygook is all about, but it is highly unlikely that many allegedly mentally ill persons will have even the faintest idea of what it means. And it is their personal liberty which is at stake. We don't like the present commitment laws, but we think that the present language is comprehensible to the average person. And we would suggest that this is incomprehensible, and it is from one practitioner to another, and is absolutely undefinable. We urge you to let this bill be tabled.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee members? Ms. Remington, I guess I would ask that you could get a copy of the Mr. Falk's amendment and have one of the members of ACLU review those as well. I would appreciate that.
And I understand they are available from staff.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Bellamy.
Steve, everyone else has testified, particularly I'm talking about the professional people, that the definition is totally unclear, and that you sit here and your testimony or your organization's testimony is the definition is perfectly clear.
More comprehensible. We've talked a lot about plain English in our statutes. And we find this the kind of thing that one or more psychiatrists may agree upon, but is totally incomprehensible to the non-practitioner.
I think I understand what you're saying there. You know, as I read the language myself, I could think of it as I might be able to understand it, but if I was to define it, I could probably think of 100 different ways to define the language that you claim is very understandable. When I have no background in psychiatry, I mean, as somewhat of a layperson, I read it and I would not. When it says dangerous to himself or others and unable to provide for basic personal needs, there's a whole lot of people that are not mentally ill that could fall into that category.
And we object to that second phrase, unable to provide for personal needs, because of the same thing you're raising, the enormous variety of circumstances that could be interpreted as that. You know, we take a very hard-nosed possession.
I understand.
You can't be deprived of your liberty unless you have been demonstrated to be a threat to the danger of others. And this is not to say that we were unsympathetic with those people with mentally ill family members. I have dealt with a manic depressive mother-in-law and have had those same things. wishing she would have care that she rejected. Nevertheless, we don't think the government should take the liberty away from an individual simply for that individual's benefit if they object. It's another matter when the rest of us are threatened by their behavior.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
I wish I got to have this editorial comment. Stevie, I wish you would have said your own testimony rather than this. This insulted me, very frankly. And your testimony, I think your own personal words, really express the position of your organization, which we understand, but you seem to do it with a little kindness and care. And this person's testimony is very insulting and degrading, in my opinion. I know you have to do what your organization tells you to. I'm just glad I asked you the question so that your own personality could come out. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Representative Bellamy, I wish Ms. Remington was in Geneva right now. I'm sure things would be worked out in a way.
Well, now I don't know.
I'm not ready to tackle that.
I think you could do a better job. Over there now.
Well, I just got to say she's generally a delight for the committee. She didn't make any analogies to, let's see, what was it? Small claims court.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bray.
I'm Don Bray, the assistant administrator of the program office for mental and emotional disturbances at the mental health division. You've heard what the bill does in great detail. I was initially going to say a few words about that. I'll limit my comments to what we anticipate to be the impact of the bill. As you noted earlier, the language is the same as the state of Washington's language. When they made that change, they studied the impact on the commitments in that state, what happened as a result of it. Prior to that, they did not have the section in their statute. They had the dangerousness criteria, but not the unable to care for self criteria. So they didn't add the unable to care for self, your own health and safety, in the broader language of our current statute, but they added it in this more specific statement of the criteria. The impact on the number of commitments up there was over 31% or so. And we figure that for this state, since we already have a broader statement of unable to provide for self, that we would only estimate about a 20% increase. And from the number of commitments we had last year, we're estimating that would turn out to be about an added 199 admissions a year, and this would require us about another 25 beds at the state hospital. Let me note that, as was pointed out earlier, commitment since the passage of the bill that she described in 1973, Senate Bill 510, has been to the division, the mental health division, not to a hospital. So all these people wouldn't necessarily have to go to the hospital. They could be committed and treated locally. That part of the statute isn't being used extensively because it's difficult to move people from a lesser to a more secure setting. So if the county commits a person locally, then it's difficult if they get worse to move them to a more secure kind of setting. Impossible. But so that, I think, makes that change. So we're anticipating that the cost would be approximately $1.4 million for 85, 87.
I'm sorry, how much?
1.4 million.
Thank you.
And of course, this is not included in the governor's budget at this point. And so, although we can understand the dilemma that it's placed when you're unable to treat somebody who needs treatment, this is the fiscal impact of it.
Are there questions from the committee members? Just Representative Springer.
Dr. Berry, just to understand, the $1.4 million, is that all state money, or is there any federal match involved in that, or?
That would be...
Or would this be the state's share if there is a federal match?
That's a total cost, including the federal part of it. Now, for the institutions for the mentally ill, the federal cost isn't as great a percent as it is in the institutions for the mentally retarded, as you know. So I don't have the exact percent on my with me, but that will be in the fiscal analysis.
Okay, we expect to receive that
yes,
later.
Sir.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that if this did represent a mix of money, that we knew that and we can await the detailed figures later.
It'll all be in there.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
Does this figure include the basic cost of the county mental health programs?
It does not. I think in our analysis, we took the position that many of these people are already being referred for evaluation, so they're already...